daily newspapers tell us that this world is very slowly and perhaps recently more rapidly dying. The U.S. has been shocked recently at the collapse of the dollar. I think the average American is beginning to get the point as far as the results of inflation, perhaps the economic policies of the United States are concerned. We might not, as the average man on the street across the country, understand the intricacies of the economy of this nation, but I think we do understand the ravages of inflation, and we are seeing before our very eyes the collapse of our currency. Gold, as I mentioned this morning, has been exploding. About 10 years ago, gold was worth $35 an ounce. That seems so long ago as far as experience is concerned, and yet it is only just one short decade ago. The dollar was worth something in money markets of the world, and people across the face of this earth could set aside or hoard dollars because a dollar was considered to have a certain value that was stable at that time. But now, even big money interests, the oil interests of the Middle East, the banks in Germany, and other major nations across Europe are dumping dollars by the millions and by the billions, driving up the price of gold to an artificially high level, or what at least economists in the United States call an artificially high level, last week of something like $450 an ounce. That price has retreated a little bit, but I think the average American is beginning to be suspect of his own currency. Of course, the prime interest rate has shot ahead, which in our lifetime, and I believe in the history of the nation, is an all-time high of 13.5%. What will it cost to borrow money for homes, for automobiles, and for other necessary purchases for the average American in the next few months and the next few years? No, we've been shocked at the collapse of the dollar and the state of the economy. The energy crunch is affecting every family. As I read here just recently, the last day or so, it's even a possibility that there might not be enough heating oil for certain areas of Wisconsin. Whether that stretches down into Illinois or goes on up into Minnesota, I'm not sure. Maybe it's just a particular problem of distribution within this state. But it is very possible that within 1 week's time, there very well may not be enough heating oil for the homes, the businesses, the facilities here in this state of Wisconsin just prior to what may be another very, very cold and grim winter. But the energy crunch is not merely a problem as far as the winter is concerned in one state, a few counties affecting a few hundred thousand or a few million people, but is beginning to affect every nation on the face of this earth. In fact, many nations today face the collapse of their entire economy because of the skyrocketing cost of oil, now $20 a barrel or over on the spot markets in Europe and the Middle East, and the countries controlling such a major percentage of the proven reserves of oil in this world are considering now, yet this autumn, sometime after the Feast of Tabernacles, of raising that price another $2 per barrel, another 10%. And so instead of gasoline costing simply a dollar a gallon as it does today, which may be a little bit shocking to us here in this room in our lifetime, probably next year by the Feast of Tabernacles, it'll be at least $1.50, may even be $2 a gallon. And we're already having to begin to figure in the cost of gasoline for the church member families across the country and where they can afford to attend the feast next year. And we may very well have to increase the number of festival sites to 2, 3, or more new areas simply because of this energy crunch and the cost of gasoline, maybe even the availability of it, particularly if the president institutes a rationing plan for the country. The threat of war is ever present this week, this month, this year. Southeast Asia is aflame again. Perhaps right after the Feast of Tabernacles, as you go home, you may be greeted by headlines across the front page of your local newspaper that China again is at war with Vietnam, because the Chinese are already amassing troops on the border to teach the Vietnamese another lesson as they look at it. Perhaps when Mr. Armstrong sets foot behind the bamboo curtain, that nation may very well be engaged in another serious border clash with the Vietnamese. What's going to happen as far as India and Pakistan is concerned is any man's guess, but Pakistan now has announced that it has the capability to create atomic weapons, and so proudly has become the first Islamic nation on earth to control atomic weapons. And perhaps they're ready to try to teach India a lesson, considering the beating they took in the last border dispute between those two countries. Africa is aflame. Just recently, they have removed the three most despotic rulers in the country. But still, the black nations of Africa are facing difficulties, border disputes, open warfare, tribal difficulties from coast to coast and from north to south. And so all of the nation of Africa is threatened with the prospect of warfare this next year. The Middle East is still a hot spot. It makes little difference what President Carter seems to have, or at least several months ago, seemed to have achieved in the Middle East disputes, because there are still not only border clashes there, people dying daily, whether in attacks by the PLO, the Palestinians, or the retaliatory attacks by the nation of Israel. The Middle East is still a hot spot. And Die Welt, a German magazine of some repute, not only in Germany and Europe, but around the world, a magazine that we take in our news bureau in Pasadena, has now said in an article that the situation, the conditions in the Middle East are so critical and present so much of an insoluble problem that the Middle East itself could be the trigger to World War III. I think that's the first time we have heard a serious magazine comment about a problem on the earth at this time in that serious a language. No, the world and all of us have been shocked, wondering what does the future hold? And mankind across the earth is perplexed about next week, next month, next year, and the future and what it holds. And I think in the Church of God, we've been shocked awake by the realities of living in this age, the end age, as Mr. Armstrong says, and has been saying repeatedly now, recently, pointing up the danger that we face, that Satan the devil is trying to destroy the worldwide Church of God. We've seen the departure of Garner Ted Armstrong. We've seen the departure of a number of ministers. Last winter, about the 4th of January, we were hit by a sudden attack from the state of California, lining up armed troops outside the doors of the Hall of Administration in Pasadena, forcing their way in and literally physically taking control at that period of time of the facilities at the headquarters, as far as publishing the college is concerned, of the Worldwide Church of God. We're still under, or still facing anyway, difficulties from that problem with the state, still entangled in legal matters, still facing the prospect, depending upon appeals to federal courts, the decisions made within the California judicial system as to whether or not the Worldwide Church of God can control its interests, its property, its finances, its institutions in the state of California or not. And of course, the resultant cash flow crisis shocked the work a very great deal, even affecting the results of the work for this entire year. Well, brethren, how are you coping? How are you coping spiritually in this time worldwide of upset, this time of national confusion, this time of persecution as far as the church is concerned, this time of difficulty as we have proceeded since the last Feast of Tabernacles into one more year, just a little bit closer to the return of Christ, the establishment of the millennium, the return of Christ, and the coming kingdom of God? How are we coping? Well, brethren, this Feast of Tabernacles, God's annual festival days, have a great deal to do with whether you and I are able to cope with the problems, the difficulties that we face, not only within the work, persecution from without, and the confusion in the age, nationally and internationally and around the world in the age in which we live, but if we're to remain stable, if we're to grow, if we're to develop, if we're to be able to fulfill the commission which God has given this age of the work, which Mr. Armstrong has so often spoken to us about and mentioned in his keynote address last night, then you and I must strengthen ourselves at this Feast of Tabernacles and understand the purpose of it, what this festival means, what the Feast of Tabernacles stands for, where it is positioned, and why in the overall master plan that God has for all human life on this earth and for us as his servants. Let me just quote again from the festival brochure this year in Mr. Armstrong's initial article. He says, "Greetings, everybody, and welcome to the greatest, the largest annual festival or convention held annually now on the face of the earth." And the second sentence is what I want to emphasize. "And this year's festival," he says, "may prove to be, because of the condition of the world, because of the fact that we're plunging further into the end of the age, a unique time in all of history. There's never been a time, there's never been an age, no man, no woman, no family, no people have ever had 2 feet on the face of this earth living in an age such as we live in today. Just prior to the return of Christ, when Satan the devil is thrashing about as wildly as he possibly can, not only to destroy the world, but to destroy us, and probably thrashing about and working the devices that he has to work a whole lot more effectively on us than he ever has in the past. Have you ever stopped to think about that? Satan has had 6,000 years of experience in attempting to destroy mankind. When Satan faced Adam, Adam was probably, in Satan's opinion anyway, somewhat naive, perhaps easily confused, upset, persuaded to make the decisions that he did. But over the years, he has had some 6,000 years, millions and billions of lives with whom to work. Servants of God down through the years, from Elijah and Elisha to the prophets Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, to the life of Christ itself. The early New Testament apostles and the church eras throughout history leading up to this important, unique time in which you and I live, in which God's family for the first resurrection is going to be made complete and the bride of Christ will prepare itself. And those who are going to be, the number who are going to be in the first resurrection will come to completeness, to fulfillment, and finally the resurrection and eternal life. But there never has been a period of time like this as far as opportunity is concerned, as far as the work of God is concerned on earth, for what God is doing just prior to Christ's return. But also there's never been a time so fraught with danger for us as individuals, a time when we need to cling to God's master plan and to understanding that plan step by step and stage by stage to live and to relive the meaning of the festival. And to be sure at this Feast of Tabernacles that we don't misuse the wealth that God has given us in the form of second tithe, where we're able to afford transportation and housing and meals and restaurants, and simply let the feast degenerate into a kind of amusement-filled vacation, but rather to have our minds on the purpose for which we're here and to put that first and foremost, to be spiritually filled and to have our minds renewed as to the purpose which God is carrying out now, because this Feast of Tabernacles pictures the time immediately ahead of us, the millennium following the return of Christ, a time when all nations on earth are going to have a chance to understand the truth and to become converted for the first time. No, this festival, as we come so much closer to Christ's return, may very well be one of the most important Feast of Tabernacles in the New Testament era or history of God's church for some 1900 years. Let's go back to the beginning and to rehearse on this Sabbath day a little bit about the meaning of this festival and take the opportunity to look into a service that took place 1500 years ago, a service that was conducted during the Feast of Tabernacles itself, back before the time of Christ, back before Christ's life on this earth, and see what was taught concerning the Feast of Tabernacles. Did people in the Old Testament, did the prophets of God who understood God's plan, who kept these festivals year in and year out, did they understand anything about the future? Did they know what this festival represents? Did the servants of God in the Old Testament understand the same thing about the Feast of Tabernacles that we understand today? Or is there perhaps in the back of our minds a thought once in a while, a question occasionally, has Mr. Armstrong maybe made up some of these things? Is that what the Bible really teaches? Does the Feast of Tabernacles picture a time of the millennium on this earth? Well, we're going to look at a sermon, in fact, a church service that was conducted 1,500 years ago, and see what was recorded anyway, excerpts of a sermon that took place a long, long time ago. Let's go back to Exodus, the 19th chapter, where God introduces his annual Sabbaths. Because they'd never been given to a people prior to this time, God had dealt with individuals. He had dealt with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and servants of his throughout history up to this point, various individuals and various families, but he had never dealt with a nation of millions of people. And so how was he going to get across what his purpose, what his plan was, and to keep his identity known to these individuals he was calling out? Well, the means by which he devised it, at least in part, were these annual festival days, because they picture God's master plan for the creation and for mankind on earth. And apart from God's annual Sabbath days, you simply can't understand. You can't identify who God is. I'm going to prove that to you in a minute. You can't even identify the true God. Not only can you not identify God, you cannot understand the purpose of life on this earth. I was reading a comment from the Archbishop of England recently in a newspaper, or a magazine article rather, and he said something to the effect that there is definitely, looking at human history, a relationship between God in heaven and man on earth. But he said, as far as he knows, there has never yet been given a satisfactory explanation as to the meaning of that relationship. Now, isn't that pathetic? Isn't that sad? That a national church, hundreds of years old, in this century, in this modern 20th century, this decade of technology, of sending men to the moon and back, a time when you can obliterate all mankind off the face of the earth in a matter of seconds, in an exchange of nuclear or hydrogen weapons between the superpowers, to have a national church and the representative of that church explaining the fact, or stating the fact, that man's relationship to God at this point isn't even understood. The reason that the nation of England, Ephraim, in the Bible, does not understand its purpose, nor does it identify the true God, is historically simply because they rejected God's annual holy days 2,500 years ago. These annual holy days of God are of more significance and are of greater meaning and greater importance to us in God's church today, perhaps, than we can recognize or realize. And certainly, as Mr. Armstrong said, the Feast of Tabernacles is the most important activity on the face of the earth this week. That there is no more significant meeting on earth. There are no more significant sessions, whether it's the United Nations or whether it's an economic conference or whatever it might be, pales into insignificance. When you understand historically the vitality, the meaning, and the importance of the Feast of Tabernacles to any people whom God has called. And you know, it really makes little difference how large the group is, because we're going to see as we get into the book or books of Ezra and Nehemiah, that one of the greatest feasts of tabernacles in God's eyes, one of the most important, one of the most significant festivals that we're observing here today, was kept by but 50,000 people. And we have more than that observing the Feast of Tabernacles right here in the United States. No, there are plenty of us, from God's point of view, 100,000 worldwide in a variety of nationalities and languages. There are plenty of us to keep the most important or one of the greatest feasts of tabernacles in 1900 years. We're not too small. We're not insignificant in God's eyes, not in the way that he looks at or judges things. Back in Exodus 19, let's notice in verse 4, he says, "See, you see what I have done unto the Egyptians and how I brought you out in this Exodus on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself." He said, "Now therefore," and this is about 3 months now after the Exodus, and this period of time is Pentecost, if we have the right date, and I don't know that it can be proved to the year, but we believe it's about 1487 years B.C. "Now therefore," he said, "if you will obey my voice indeed," God's proposing what we call the old covenant, "and keep my covenant, then," he said, "you shall be a peculiar treasure." No, I think it would be a good idea to just mark the words, if you haven't done it, peculiar treasure. The bride of Christ is a peculiar treasure. But as Mr. Armstrong has been emphasizing, the bride of Christ needs to be cleaned up, strengthened, stabilized, which is the purpose for these annual Sabbath days, and prepared for the return of Christ. But we need to think of ourselves in that kind of terminology, that we're peculiar, not awe, but special, that we're a treasure in God's eyes, and that we need to shine those jewels. We need to expose them. We need to express the many facets, such as are on a finely cut piece of jewelry, to expose it so that it might shine and flash with brilliance. And that brilliance is the Spirit of God living in every one of us and expressing it in obedience, expressing it in keeping the covenant that we have made with God. And he said, "You shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." And they answered then that all that God has spoken we will do. It's just too bad they didn't. It's just unfortunate that throughout the history of Israel, so many, many times, except for an occasional servant of God, a Moses, a Joshua, an Elijah or Elisha, Jeremiah and Isaiah with the kings Hezekiah and Josiah, except for just a very, very few periods of time, the nation of Israel and the nation of Judah rejected God's laws. And whenever they rejected those laws and they cast aside God's annual holy days, they always had national trouble. God's Sabbaths, God's holy days are always throughout history in the Bible associated with God's presence, his blessing, his protection, and his work. And the absence or the neglect of those annual Sabbaths is always and inevitably associated with pain, with suffering, with confusion, with destruction, and eventually with captivity. It's just too bad that our peoples in this country today don't look to their Bibles, try to find out where they are in history, repent and turn to God's holy days. Now, we've taken solace in the wealth that God's given us in raising us up, giving us the birthright that was Joseph's, and opening those blessings beginning in the year of 1800 in the Louisiana Purchase, and we simply feel somehow we're probably better than other people on earth, that the United States miraculously is the land of hope and glory. Baloney! Those simply are the blessings that are given to us in this day and age that God promised Israel so long ago. And as a people, certainly with the immorality and the breakdown in the families and the way we've treated the wealth that we have and the racial disputes within the borders of our nation, the problems of politicians and a president resigning in disgrace, we can't say we're better than other people on earth, hardly. We might be more wealthy. We might have more opportunities. But I don't think our nation can hold its head up and say in any respect that we're better. But if we had kept God's holy days, our nation could be stable. Just as the nation of Israel or the nation of Judah years ago when they kept God's days. And so God has them appear before him and he adds something new. If you read in chapter 20 of the commandments that God gave, he codified them here. Not that he invented the commandments. They weren't new in any sense at all because God's servants had kept these laws throughout history. But he did add something new over in chapter 23. Notice verse 14. This is something new as far as a nation is concerned, and something that these people, other than the individuals whom God had dealt with throughout history, knew nothing about. "Three times or three seasons in the year shall you keep a feast unto me, and the feast of unleavened bread in the spring," of course, including the Passover. And all that he's showing here are the three basic seasons. He's not enumerating the annual holy days at all. That's done later in Leviticus, repeated in Numbers and Deuteronomy. But he's showing the three festival seasons. And he said, you shall keep a feast of unleavened bread, and then in verse 16, the feast of harvest, or Pentecost, or first fruits, the first fruits of your labor which you've sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering. And God's annual Sabbaths were built around the harvest seasons, the small early spring harvest, representing the smaller, more limited number of people who will be in the first resurrection or harvested by God, and then the great harvest, spiritually the great harvest of humans, of souls in the fall. And that time when we know that initially God, after returning to this earth, will open up the minds of men who are still alive on the earth and finally expanding into all humanity who has ever lived in the last great day. So the Feast of Ingathering, or the Feast of Tabernacles, is in the end of the year. And three times in verse 17 shall all of your families or your males appear before God. Well, why did God give them these annual Sabbath days? What was it to do? Was it to be sort of a religious talisman for the nation of Israel? Were they to be able to pin a pin on their lapel, as you would a Kiwanis button, that indicates that you kept the Feast of Tabernacles or the Passover that year? Or is there something a whole lot more practical, beneficial, vital, and needed for all peoples concerning these Sabbath days? Well, of course, God hasn't given them in vanity or for some vain show. He didn't have people come at the Feast of Tabernacles to Jerusalem and to live in booths just to somehow satisfy his ego, that he wanted people to crowd around in that city and to worship or to honor him. It was for their benefit. It did something for them. And it did basically two things. It identified year in and year out so they could not forget. But it identified year in, year out, the true God. And number two, we find here the initial revelation of God's plan to a nation. And that revelation throughout history was progressive. The understanding in detail, the depth of these annual holy days, from the Passover right through the last great day at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, or actually after the Feast of Tabernacles, came to be more deeply understood throughout generations and centuries and millennia. And that understanding is progressive, and it's something that we can understand perhaps a whole lot more deeply because we have so much more written. God's revealed so much more. We have all the writings of an Isaiah, a Jeremiah, and Ezekiel that talk about the purpose of this annual festival, which ancient Israel didn't have. We have the minor prophets that refer to the return of Christ and what will happen to the nations on this earth and how God's going to prosper them and how he's going to feed and to clothe them. The revelation of God's plan throughout history has been progressive. And not only the revelation of that plan has been progressive, but the opportunity to preach the meaning of those things. And so today, Mr. Armstrong is able to go to all the world through broadcasting, through telecasting, through the printed word, but also to visit kings, prime ministers, leaders in government, leaders in economy, leaders in the educational world of many nations. And now after the Feast of Tabernacles, we'll even be breaching the bamboo curtain and going into a major communist nation, representing God with his word, his way, for the first time into that country, considering the pagan religions and the non-entity of religion even within the country, for how many thousands of years? Maybe for the very first time in all history. Because the Bible is an Israelitish book, and God has never dealt with the nations of this world. But he is now just beginning to do so because a witness and a warning is at least going out. God's not converting those people. But he is beginning to touch them. He's beginning to reach them. He's beginning to deal with them for the first time in the histories of those peoples. That's why this era is so important. That's why this Feast of Tabernacles, for us to strengthen ourselves in what God is doing and what the future holds in a time of confusion, is so important. That's why Mr. Armstrong urged all of us to fast and to pray and to prepare for this feast and to desire to understand more deeply spiritually who we are, what our commission and responsibilities are, and where we stand before world history, before all prophecy, 90% of which is yet to be fulfilled. So these annual holy days are absolutely vital to us. And throughout history, they have been vital even to the survival of nations. Now, if we're to have any understanding of God's plan and our purpose in it, we've got to keep these annual holy days just as it was true for ancient Israel and ancient Judah. But let's notice a tragic decision, probably, apart from what Adam himself did, the most tragic single decision in the history of mankind. Certainly in the history of the nation of Israel. Turn back to 1 Kings, the 12th chapter. God had given Israel his laws back in about 1487 B.C., and we're going to jump down through the wanderings in the wilderness and the initial entrance into the promised land, the days of Joshua and the judges, and even the early days of the kings. Of Saul, of David, and of Solomon. And those people by this time in 1 Kings, the 12th chapter, are all gone. And we're down to about 950 B.C. So we've jumped ahead some 500 years. And at this point, God divided the nation of Israel into two separate nations, Judah to the south, and then what was called simply Israel, the northern kingdom to the north. And in the northern kingdom, God placed a man called Jeroboam. And he was to be king over that nation. And it was of God to separate Israel and Judah. But let's notice what happened beginning in verse 25 of chapter 12. And Jeroboam built Shechem in Mount Ephraim. Jeroboam was an Ephraimite, or he was an Englishman. He was British as we look at it today. And he dwelt therein, and he went out from thence and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, in other words, he began to look at what he felt was a problem facing the continuance of the division between those two nations, rather than simply trust God. Now, God had promised them if they had obeyed Him, if they would only look to Him, if they would only trust Him and depend upon Him and keep His annual holy days, not only would He bless them and be with them and keep the nation separate, but He would prosper them forever. And so their future was absolutely secure. Here we are today wondering, what's going to happen to the dollar tomorrow? Will gold go up or come down? What's our future? Can we afford to buy a week's groceries and pay for fuel oil and buy a full tank of gasoline? Those people didn't have that problem if they had kept God's annual holy days. But he said, now the kingdom shall return to Judah, the house of David to the south, if they go down to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And so in verse 28, whereupon the king took counsel, and he made two calves of gold, and he said, giving an excuse here, look, it's too much to keep the Feast of Tabernacles anymore. Our peoples have been doing this off and on, at least the religious zealots among us have been doing this off and on for hundreds of years, and we can keep that feast up here. After all, God has made us a separate nation. And since he's made us a separate nation, we'll just keep that Feast of Tabernacles right up here in the northern kingdom. You don't have to go down to Jerusalem anymore. And so he set up these idols, one in Bethel, which simply means the house of God. And Bethel, by the way, was only about 20 miles from Jerusalem. So it was kind of a hollow argument, wasn't it? Why is it too much to go to Jerusalem another 20 miles further? And actually, for some of the people who lived over across the Jordan, which were parts of the tribe of Manasseh and Reuben and Gad, it was probably a little bit closer even to go to Jerusalem than it was to go to Bethel. In other words, he had just told them a lie, is what it amounts to. An excuse, a gimmick. But Bethel was the major shrine that Jeroboam set up. And this thing, in verse 30, became a sin. And what is indicated here is it became a national sin. And you can read over these verses very quickly. Not a whole lot is said about it here, although it's referred to many, many times throughout the remainder of the existence of the nation of Israel. And it doesn't seem to be too important. And yet when you realize the significance of what these people were doing and the fact that Jeroboam and the Israelites sealed their fate, they assured their destruction, they assured the stripping of the nation of its wealth, they assured their loss of identity, which they have lost to this day. They assured their despair and their captivity by casting off God's annual holy days. No, there's never been a time when a people has cast off the annual Sabbath days that they have ever survived. It isn't a question of isn't it nice to keep God's Sabbaths or annual holy days. Brethren, it's a question of our survival. It isn't a question of isn't it a nice religious thing to do when Mr. Armstrong, or in responding to Mr. Armstrong, when he says, prepare for the Feast of Tabernacles. Brethren, our understanding, our grasp of, our observance of this feast, which pictures the millennium, is a question of survival. It's a question of our survival in a time of greater confusion than our peoples in this era have ever known, of greater upset and difficulty. Well, it's a little bit like flying into the eye of a hurricane. I was reading an article here just the other day about some pilots who fly for the U.S. Weather Bureau, former military pilots. I guess they're used to things of this sort. But they take one of these large four-engine Orion transport planes, and I guess especially fit it structurally so that it's able to withstand the battering. But they start at the outer edge of a hurricane and literally fly right into the eye of it. And while they're flying into the eye of the hurricane, it nearly destroys the plane. In fact, when they got this one plane inside the eye, which is about 30 miles in diameter, they flew around for several hours in there because they had to repair the thing before they could fly out the other side. It's that damaging. Well, you have to have instruments in a plane to tell you where to go when you can't see the ground. You don't know from your own senses because of the battering which way is up and which way is down. You have to look absolutely directly at the instruments and fly the plane by instrumentation, and you can't tell according to your feeling where you are, and you can't follow your sense of balance or your own inclinations. If you do, you'll crash the plane every time, in spite of the fact that you might become almost fearful as it's being battered virtually to pieces and to the point of having to be repaired before you can turn around and go out the other side. But we need to cling to these annual holy days and to the leadership that God gives them through the battering that we're going to go through in the future as we enter this period of tribulation that Mr. Armstrong mentioned last night. If we are to remain stable, to remain members of God's church, to remain or to retain rather possession of God's Holy Spirit, and to go on in a sense, to the eye of the hurricane, to that time of stability, which is going to be following the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. No, if we're to continue as individuals or as a work, we, just as Israel or Judah or all of God's people, must keep these annual holy days in the spirit. Not just as a time of general amusement, because we have a little bit more second tithe to spend. So this became a national sin, and it foreshadowed, it assured the destruction of the nation, because the nation of Israel, once they veered away from these annual Sabbath days, never in all history repented. Did you realize that? That you can look back over the history of the nation of Judah and you can find a king who maybe started out righteous, perhaps didn't end up too well, or you can find someone like a Hezekiah and a Josiah, and they were, in God's eyes, righteous kings and were associated with Isaiah and Jeremiah, respectively, and attempted to clean up the nation, to reinstitute the annual holy days, or to reestablish them in the importance of the people. But of the northern kingdom of the nation of Israel, those people never had one righteous king. They never observed one Feast of Tabernacles in all their history from 950 to 721 B.C. God sent prophet after prophet. He sent Isaiah. He sent Hosea. Jeremiah even had a period of time there before. Not Jeremiah is not what I mean, but Hosea and Amos and Micah before the nation of Israel to the north went captive. But they never responded. They ridiculed God's prophets. They laughed at them. And what God's prophets had to say simply had no meaning, even though the eternal God himself sent men that we look back on now and respect and honor as servants of God so many hundreds of years ago. So he made a house of high places, and he made priests of the lowest of the people, and kicked out the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the eighth month, a counterfeit. And it makes no difference how sincere you are. Actually, no one commits suicide in this way. These people were, in their own understanding, although in rebellion, probably sincere. They may have been, to a certain extent, well-meaning. They may have thought, well, it's just all right. We can keep a feast in the eighth month just as well as the seventh month. But they couldn't. And it was not a feast of God by any means. It was something in verse 33 in the middle of the month, which it says, in the middle of the verse, which it says Jeremiah simply devised in his own heart. And so that precipitated a period of history such has never been in the world to this day, as far as the nation of Israel is concerned, where they increasingly lost the knowledge of God. They went into captivity. They lost their identity. And those people do not know who they are to this day. And Mr. Armstrong can broadcast to the British Isles, as we had a broadcast here a number of years ago from the ship stations. We can broadcast and telecast all across this nation, print the Plain Truth magazine to our heart's content, and the average American not only does not know, but simply would not believe, in spite of the proof, that this is the nation of Israel that God is dealing with. Those people, because they lost the annual holy days, totally lost all knowledge of the true God, and even lost the identity of all things, lost the identity of their own peoples, and now consider themselves to be descendants from who knows what, from nation to nation. No, it's a dynamic period. A period of time in which the nation of Israel was to disappear as a result of losing the annual holy days, and in spite of whichever servants of God that Christ sent, they simply rejected them. No, the annual holy days are absolutely vital to the survival of any nation or any people. You know, another thing to remember concerning these annual Sabbaths is that in the Bible, whenever there was a restoration, whenever there was a period of time when a people or individuals, maybe it wasn't even an entire nation, but when a people sought to serve God, the Feast of Tabernacles, this festival that we're observing now, and all of God's annual festivals are always rediscovered and always play a prominent part in that period of restoration. Have these festivals played a prominent part in this era of the work? Absolutely. What was one of the first things when God began to separate Mr. Armstrong for the work that he has called him to do, did he test Mr. Armstrong on? Well, beginning in 1927, he began to keep the annual festivals, just the two of them, just Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong, and for seven, probably what seemed rather long years, they were absolutely alone, because God was going to restore his way to this earth in a unique time, the time of the end of the age, and he had to know, and he had to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Mr. Armstrong would be faithful to the annual Sabbath days and to this Feast of Tabernacles before he could use him for the job, the commission he had. And Mr. Armstrong was faithful not only those 7 years, but he has been faithful for 53 years. A longer period of time than the festivals were really kept faithfully, probably at any period of time from the days of Joshua down to this day today. No, to think that we could be having this year one of the most important, one of the most crucial, and one of the greatest feasts of tabernacles, depending on our response, our participation as individuals, and how close we all are to God. To think that that's beyond the realm of possibility, that we're just a tiny group, and how could what we do here reflect that way, that dramatically, against all the history of the observance of God's laws? No, it's not beyond the realm of possibility at all. Not by a long shot, when you understand how God's holy days have been discarded and cast aside, and how even entire nations have gone into captivity because of doing that, particularly in light of the fact that this age, this era, this period of restoration has been faithful for 53 years in keeping these festivals. No work of God, as far as the history of the Bible is concerned, no single work of God, whether it's an entire nation or simply a group of people, has ever been sustained apart from the annual Sabbath days, apart from this Feast of Tabernacles. Let's go back to Ezra, which to me is the culmination of one of the most interesting periods in the entire Bible, certainly apart from just the life of Christ itself, but is one of the most interesting periods from the time when Jeroboam cast aside the annual holy days for another 500 years down to about 450 B.C., the time, finally, the end of the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, when so very, very much was done, when God sent so many of the prophets whom we look back on now, not only as men of God, but whose writings contain for us so much of the history, the prophecy, the example for what we're doing even right here as far as the Feast of Tabernacles is concerned this year. But the book of Ezra begins in chapter 1 with the captivity of Judah. And now it mentions, of course, the captivity of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar occurred in, well, three stages, actually, from 604 to 586 B.C. But now we're in the first year of Cyrus, the king in Babylon, and that's about 538 B.C. And he's going to make a proclamation, and that proclamation is to go back to the city of Jerusalem, to the nation of Judah, and rebuild the temple of God. What we're seeing here, then, is a restoration after 70 years, when there was no temple, when God began to send the nation of Judah finally into captivity, a restoration of God's way in that city. And if it's to be a restoration, we must find the annual holy days kept. The question is, will we? Well, Zerubbabel in chapter 2, verse 1, returned, chapter 2, verse 1 and verse 2, and he went back with a little over 42,000 people to rebuild the city. But notice, then in chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, what's one of the first things they do when they return to the city of Jerusalem? And when the seventh month was come, the seventh month is the month of God's annual festivals in the autumn, of trumpets, of atonement, tabernacles, and the last great day. The children, the people, gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem, and they read what was written in the law of Moses. And notice verse 4, they kept the Feast of Tabernacles. And they kept it not as Jeroboam changed it, or not according to their own inclinations, but they kept it as it was written. Just as we keep the Feast of Tabernacles today, we're keeping it as it's written. Beginning with the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. And in verse 5, it mentions, they kept then all the set feasts of the Lord. And the reason it sums it up that way is because we're dealing with a period of years, over a period of time here. We're going to be jumping 15 years all of a sudden. This period in the book of Ezra begins, as I said, in about 538 B.C. It ends in the book of Nehemiah in 444 B.C. So those two books, this period of restoration, covers a full 100 years. But during this initial period of time, they kept all of the set feasts of God, just as the worldwide Church of God does today. Verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, that's trumpets. From the very first day of the seventh month, they began to offer the burnt offerings, but the foundation of the temple, of course, since they had just returned to Jerusalem, hadn't been laid as yet. It's interesting to read, perhaps when you get home, the history of chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 1, mentions the adversaries. Of course, trying to destroy, trying to frustrate, trying to stop the work that God was doing in the rebuilding of the temple. And whenever God has had a work, there have always been adversaries, very much like the receivership in the state of California trying to control the work in the church right now. But these people were faithful, and they continued to keep God's annual holy days. And of course, the temple was built. Eventually, the wall was built around the city of Jerusalem, and the city of Jerusalem was reestablished because they had remained faithful throughout this 100-year period of time to God's annual Sabbath days. Notice chapter 5 and verse 1. As a result of the adversaries, the work was stopped, I guess you might say it. They forced the cessation of the work on the temple for about 15 years. And even though it was God's work, even though Christ had commissioned the building of the temple, as Mr. Armstrong says, we must work as hard as we possibly can. Many times there are frustrations and trials. Many times God's work is held back. Many times it might even be almost stopped because of the efforts of Satan. But as long as we remain faithful and true to God and keep these annual holy days, God will carry us through to the fulfillment of our commission. And the church can be made ready as a part of that commission for the return of Christ, just as the ancient temple was rebuilt and the city of Jerusalem was restored. These annual holy days are absolutely of the utmost importance. But in chapter 5, verse 1, then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied unto the Jews. And if you just sort of read over that, you don't recognize the significance of it. But God sent two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. And this is in about 520 B.C. now, some 15 years after they had returned. But when did they prophesy? Well, to find out when they prophesied, we're going to have to leave the book of Ezra and jump into the minor prophets. And it's unfortunate that the King James Version, the version, whichever one you have in your own possession, is arranged the way that it is. And I think that Satan has probably, to a certain extent, had a hand in that, because it tends to make the Old Testament confusing. You don't see the relationship of Isaiah, Jeremiah, of Daniel and Ezekiel together with all of the minor prophets. And the minor prophets in our minds, probably since it's termed minor, you think, well, it's of less importance. If I were to ask you to hold up your hands of which prophets in the Bible you read the least, undoubtedly it would be the minor prophets. I'm sure all of you read Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, other books in the Old Testament a whole lot more than the minor prophets. But the minor prophets are not minor in importance, just simply shorter in length. But every bit as important as servants of God, effective in the work that God was doing, particularly what Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi, who probably was Ezra, did in the fulfilling of the commission in their day and their age. The minor prophets actually encompass the whole of the majority of biblical prophecy. Hosea begins before Isaiah, and Malachi completes his work after Daniel. So the major prophets in the Bible are actually encompassed in time by this book called the 12, which really is basically one book, which we call the minor prophets today. But in the book of Haggai, notice in chapter 1, in the second year of Darius the king, this is why we know it's about 520 B.C., in the sixth month, Haggai began to prophesy, and his prophecy takes place in 3 months, the sixth month, and then notice chapter 2, when is he prophesying? In the seventh month. Here we are again, just as we saw a little bit ago in the book of Ezra. Suddenly we're in the seventh month, and God's servants are doing something. We saw back in Ezra chapter 5 that because of the prophesying and the work of Haggai and Zechariah, which began in the sixth month and went to the seventh month, they were able to go ahead and to build the temple. And so they prophesied in the seventh month. That's this annual festival month we're in now. So crucial to the rebuilding of the temple, so crucial was the observance of these annual holy days to the restoration that God was establishing of the nation of Judah, the completing of the Old Testament, the authorization or the canonization of the Old Testament of that part of the Bible which we have for us to this day. So vital and so important. And this Feast of Tabernacles was the observance of it was a tremendously important part of that restoration. What we saw in Ezra 5 verse 1 is expressed as to what was said and what was done throughout the entire book of Haggai, of both these chapters. in the 7th month and the 1 20th day of the month. When is that? What does that mean to us? Well, that's this next Friday to us. This year, that is the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. The 1 20th day of the 7th month is the final day, not the last great day, but the final day of the Feast of Tabernacles, of this 7-day feast. And what we're seeing preserved for us in history to this day is an ancient service that was held on the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. And what do you suppose they preached about? Did they preach anything different than we are today, or that we will throughout the remainder of this feast? Were they preaching, do you suppose? Is it possible that God's servants 1,500 years ago preached about the millennium concerning the Feast of Tabernacles just as we're doing today and will throughout this feast? Is that remotely possible? Or did we make those things up in this day and age? Well, what we have preserved for us, beginning in verse 3, is an ancient sermon from a prophet of God. In this chapter, verse 2, God told him to speak unto Zerubbabel and to Joshua, who was the high priest, and the people. The residue simply means those that came back from Babylon out of captivity and were there in Jerusalem. So that obviously is a service, because he was speaking to the governor, the high priest, and to all of the people during the Feast of Tabernacles, the very last day of Tabernacles back in 520 B.C. Fascinating insight into this festival sermon. Let's notice beginning in verse 3. He says, "Who is left among you?" And what we're going to find here is so much like Mr. Armstrong today. Here, an ancient prophet of God, but he ties together the plan of God with the work that those people were doing. The work that they had to do was the rebuilding of the temple, but he tied scriptures in with it, and you could spend 2 or 3 hours simply going through the margins in your Bible and tying together scriptures that were written before Haggai preached. You have to ask yourself, where did Haggai get the knowledge that the Feast of Tabernacles represents the millennium? Did he make that up in his mind? Did Mr. Armstrong draw that out of whole air? Or is it recorded in the Bible? Have God's servants always looked back to those individuals and those servants of God whom God used before them by a generation or 100 years or a longer period of time than that? Sure they did. They read what was written, they studied what was written, and God then inspired them to speak to the people in their day and age, just as he's been inspiring Mr. Armstrong concerning this feast for 53 years. This sermon is no different than the sermons preached during the Feast of Tabernacles in this era, in this day. And a minister could have taken this and preached a whole sermon by tying other scriptures in with it and by referring simply to the scriptures that Haggai is partially quoting, even to the point of using the same terminology from scriptures that had been written 100 or more years before his lifetime. And we could have preached the entire sermon this afternoon on this holy day of the Feast of Tabernacles out of the 2nd chapter of the book of Haggai about the millennium. And so in verse 3, he begins with what I'm sure was an attention-grabbing introduction, as Mr. Armstrong has used for so many years, and tying it in with the work, with some of the threats to their lives, with the problems, the difficulties, the contingencies they faced in the rebuilding of the temple, and said, "Who is left among you that saw this house some 70 years before? And how do you see it now?" Of course, it still lay in rubble. And only the foundation had been laid by this point, but it hadn't been built. "Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Yet," he says, "now be strong, O Zerubbabel." And Zerubbabel is even a type of Christ throughout the book of Haggai and the minor prophets. And he said, "O Joshua, son of Jozadak, be strong, all you people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, So he was tying in the meaning of this festival with the work that those people had to do. Let's just turn back. Hold your place here, and we're going to refer real quickly to two or three scriptures, and I think you'll find it interesting during the feast to make this a family study of your own. But turn back to Jeremiah, the 46th chapter. Now, Jeremiah lived back during the days of Josiah, just prior to the captivity. Josiah, and then on to the captivity itself. And remember, Jeremiah eventually went north to Britain and accompanied the king's daughters. They married into the royal line, and the transfer from Pharez to Zara, or the healing of the breach that Mr. Armstrong's written about in the British, U.S. and British Commonwealth and Prophecy booklet. And so this book of Jeremiah was prophesied, was written, and was stated, if you use a figure of around 604, depending on the parts of the book, B.C., or in what, 520 B.C., it was written little less than 100 years before. It would be like looking back on the latter part of the 18th or the 19th century, the 1800s in this country, not too far before, and yet a servant of God whom Haggai respected. And so he's referring to a promise that he gave in Jeremiah 46, verse 27 and 28, and says, "But fear not, O my servant Jacob, and be not dismayed, O Israel, because I will save you from afar off." Well, he had just brought them back from Babylon, a type of being brought out of the captivity in the future. "And your seed from the land of their captivity, and Jacob shall return and be in rest and at ease, and none shall make him afraid." And he says, "O my servant Jacob, I am with you. I will make a full end of the nations where I have driven you, but not make a full end of thee, and correct you in measure, yet I will not leave you wholly unpunished." Well, God punished them. He sent them into captivity, but he brought them back out at this period of time to rebuild the temple, and had told them to not be afraid. And so he's referring to a prophecy that has to do with the millennium, when God will bring Jacob back out of captivity, when he will make a full end of all nations, and was using what they were doing in this restoration period as a type of the future return. And so he's preaching here about the millennium, but he's tying it in with the work that they were doing. Well, let's go on then, reading on down through verse 5 and into verse 6. "For thus says the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heaven and earth, the sea and the dry land." Now, is that a prophecy of any significance? Did he make that up out of whole cloth? Or is he simply referring to another prophecy of Jeremiah concerning the end and concerning the millennium? Of course, the answer is yes. Turn back to Jeremiah 51. In Jeremiah, the 51st chapter, let's just read verse 33. "For thus..." Excuse me, am I in the right place here? Yes, verse 33. "For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, the daughter of Babylon is like a threshing floor. It is time to thresh her." Notice, yet a little while. Using the same terminology that Jeremiah had used nearly 100 years before, Haggai said, yet once, it is a little while, and he's going to shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land, not just Babylon, but the entire world. "And the time of her harvest shall in the future come," at the return of Christ and the ushering in of the millennium. You might notice over in Joel, the 3rd chapter, another one of the minor prophets, a minor prophet that had preceded Haggai by a long time. And Joel, the date that you could give for that would be approximately 790 B.C., even back before Isaiah and Jeremiah. So over a couple of 250 years earlier. But in Joel, the 3rd chapter, in verse 16, it says, "And the Lord shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and earth shall shake." And so what did Haggai do? He put together a prophecy about the millennium, the return of Christ, and the punishing of nations and the shaking of nations in Jeremiah, using the same terminology together with another prophecy in the book of Joel. Do we do that today? Absolutely. The same kind of sermon, referring to the same verses, only 1,500 years ago. And he said, He shall utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and earth shall shake, but the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. And so taking the principle of that, he's encouraging them to get on with the work in his day and age. In verse 7, back in Haggai, the second chapter, and I will shake all nations, and notice the desire of nations shall come. And the desire of nations could be just as well translated the desirable things, because that's what it's referring to, the wealth of all the nations left on earth at the return of Christ. And the desire of all nations shall come, and I'll fill this house with glory. Of course, in the future, the city of Jerusalem, but even using it as a type then, but of course preaching on or during the Feast of Tabernacles about the millennium. Well, are there any other scriptures in the Old Testament written by prophets of God who lived before Haggai that he could have read and been drawing on? How did he know that God was going to do that? Well, let's turn back to Isaiah, the 23rd chapter. Isaiah, who had lived approximately 200 years before this, in Isaiah 23, beginning in verse 17, and it shall come to pass after the end of 70 years, the Lord will visit Tyre. He mentions here the punishment of all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. And in verse 18, and her merchandise, her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. It shall not be treasured up, but rather God is going to use the wealth of the nations. When he returns to this earth, he's going to confiscate all that wealth and use it for people to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. So God is going to confiscate the wealth of the nations, the desirable things of the nations, and use it to feed and to clothe and to provide for the development of the world on into the millennium. That's what Haggai is writing about. It says the same thing in another minor prophet who wrote also before Haggai, back in the book of Micah. And Micah wrote again about 125 to 50 years before Haggai did. And Micah, the 4th chapter in verse 13, another scripture that he used in this sermon. And he said, arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I'll make your horn iron, and I'll make your hoofs brass, and you shall beat in pieces many people. And notice, I'll consecrate their gain, their desirable things, unto the Lord, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. In the book of Zechariah, God mentions that all the silver and the gold will be his. Of course, Zechariah prophesied at the same time as Haggai, so there's no real need to turn over to see that. But I wanted you to see that the prophecies concerning the millennium that we look back on today, that we've preached about for these 53 years, are exactly the same scriptures that God's servants during sermons within the Feast of Tabernacles have preached as far back as those prophecies were given, all the way back 1,500 years ago in this sermon on the last day of Tabernacles in 520 B.C. God's people, especially during restorations, have always kept the annual holy days. And God has given us an open door, a door of understanding in this day and in this age, to restore the truth to the earth, to restore the truth about God's master plan and the fact that this Feast of Tabernacles pictures the millennium, a time of peace, a time of prosperity, a time when God is going to take the desirable things of all nations and use them to feed and to clothe the people living on into the millennium, and to reestablish society, to reestablish the nations of mankind, and to bring them into a time of peace, but also to bring them into an opportunity for salvation, as all people's minds will be opened at that time. Well, brethren, Mr. Armstrong, when he encouraged us to fast in preparation for this festival, has encouraged us even in last night's keynote sermon to be praying for ourselves, to be praying for him and his guidance, to draw close to God, to drink deeply of the spiritual meat of the Feast of Tabernacles, was not simply trying to stir us up emotionally for our own observance of an enjoyable festival when we have a little bit more money to spend. No, these are not rituals, these annual Sabbath days, but they have to do everything to do not only with our survival and our continued understanding of God's way, but have everything to do in reliving and renewing and reviving the purpose that God is doing on this earth, drawing us closer to God, stabilizing and strengthening us, so that we living in this day, in this age, in this time of restoration, just prior to the return of Christ, with the commission of preaching this gospel across the face of the earth and preparing a bride for Christ, that might be possible to complete, just as God commissioned Zerubbabel, Haggai, Zechariah, Ezra, and Nehemiah in that era and time of restoration to rebuild the temple on the face of the earth, and that they were able to complete it because they were faithful in God's laws and remained close to God's annual Sabbath days. No, it's not ritual, but these annual festivals are just as vital for our finishing the work as it was for the survival of the northern kingdom of Israel and as it was for the rebuilding of the temple. Mr. Armstrong has been strongly emphasizing the importance of these annual Sabbath days. And perhaps this festival, well, undoubtedly, this festival has not been kept by the nation, by the physical nation of Israel for over 2,500 years, since the days of Jeroboam. It has been kept by God's church, and God has restored his way on earth at this time, and it is possible. Indeed, it's possible with the number of people that we have keeping the Feast of Tabernacles across the face of the earth, maybe being twice that of what God brought back to Jerusalem, twice that who were able to keep the Feast of Tabernacles there in the book of Ezra and in the book of Haggai. And yet God went on to say that those people a little bit later on in the book of Nehemiah kept one of the greatest festivals in the history of the nations of Israel and Judah. They kept the Feast of Tabernacles as we are 7 days, and then they kept the last great day, the eighth day, just as we do today. And if God recognized their observance, a relatively small, tiny group compared to the population of the world of some 40 or 50,000, then we can, as Mr. Armstrong urged us to do in preparing ourselves, keep one of the greatest feasts of tabernacles since Jesus Christ within the last 1900 years. Let me read to you a comment that was made in a festival brochure by the governor of the state of Arizona. And he mentions here, and he puts in these words in this article in the brochure, he captures the feeling that we ought to have at this festival in appreciating what God has given us and in keeping this feast as God intended. He says, "Without a doubt, yours is one of the finest assemblies that we've been privileged to host in this state. Your personal example is an uplifting experience for our entire community. It's a tribute to the personal and community benefits which result from a strong faith in God." He says, "As you share your experiences and devotions, your services, you will no doubt grow in unity." That's one of the purposes for these annual festivals, to be unified, to be of one mind, to be fitly framed together, as Mr. Armstrong stated last night. Grow in unity and understanding and the formation even of new goals, as God gives us the insight and the wisdom to see what he has for us to do. "My best wishes," he says, "for a most successful assembly. Your service," and how he fully grasps this, I don't think he could grasp it as we do, but he says, "Your service is the highest calling of man, the highest calling of God, and the unselfish giving of yourselves in a calling that uplifts all people." If he only understood the purpose and the significance, the meaning of this Feast of Tabernacles, he would grasp that a lot more deeply. He goes on to say, "In times of doubt, in times of fear, in times of suspicion," aren't we there? Times of confusion. The headlines tell us the world is dying. We're there in a time of doubt, of fear, of suspicion. He goes on to say, "The faith which remains true will help to anchor and preserve even the destiny of our great nation." He says, "I hope our majestic scenery and settings serve to remind and reinforce every one of you in your faith. And may this assembly, even though world events are trying and troubling, be a meaningful experience to every one of you. Well, that's what God wants us to have in even deeper terminology, as only those of us in the church can understand it. He wants us to be unified in a time of trial, a time of upset, to realize the importance of the restoration of His way and the commission that He has given us for this Feast of Tabernacles. Well, brethren, yearly the schedule is pretty much the same, with two services on the Sabbath, a service during the week beginning at 10:30 in the morning, and then a couple of services on the final holy day. The schedule is not going to change a great deal this year. But the services, the messages, and the sermons are living services and messages. Let's think about them, pray about them, live and relive the meaning of this feast, and be sure that we as a church and as individuals strengthen our lives at this Feast of Tabernacles so we can complete our commission in this age, just as Zerubbabel, Haggai, Zechariah did in their age in the building of the temple so many years ago. Let's keep this feast in the spirit and the intent of it, and go home strengthened to fulfill our commission the rest of this year.